and a collective moan of happiness went up in the crowd.
Quiet! Shouted Irma.
Despite our best efforts to hang back and stand in the warmer, soft middle of the crowd, all five of us and our little camp family had ended up in the front row that morning. It was a dangerous place to be, since prisoners on the outer edges were more vulnerable, open to attacks from bored and sometimes volatile guards and their dogs. I stood next to Matka, Luisa on her other side. Mrs. Michalski, whom we'd all watched decline quickly after losing her baby, stood between Susanna and me. Susanna had diagnosed my teacher with dysentery and severe depression, a bad combination. It had been snowing off and on since early November. To help the time go by, I watched the birds shake snow from their wings and was jealous of them for being able to come and go as they pleased. A bitter wind was slashing off the lake that morning, so we'd helped Mrs. Michalski slip two sheets of smuggled newspaper down the front of her thin cotton jacket for insulation. When Irma was not looking, we turned our backs and rubbed up against one another, trying to stay warm. The guards had erected a tall fir in a sturdy wooden base as a Christmas tree at the end of Beauty Road, and it swayed in the wind. Mrs. Michalski swayed as well, and I held her arm to steady her. Even through her cotton coat, I felt the bone of her elbow sharp against my palm. Was I already that emaciated, too? Mrs. Michalski leaned into me, and the newspaper crinkled and peeped out over the neck of her shift. I tucked the paper down out of sight. "You have to stand straight," I said. "I'm sorry, Kasia." "Count in your head. That helps." "Quiet," Susanna said to me across Mrs. Michalski's back. "Binz is coming." A wave of dread washed through the crowd as Binz rode through the camp gates and across the plots on her blue bicycle. Had she overslept, warm in her bed with her married boyfriend, Edmund? At least he wasn't there that morning. Kissing her as a prisoner was whipped, a favorite pastime. As Binz rode, she strained against the wind, one hand on the handlebar, the other on her dog's leash. Her black wool cape fanned out behind her. She reached the Riviere, leaned her bicycle against the wall, and navigated the cobblestones with her farm girl's stride, dog by her side, straining at its collar. As Binz walked, she waved her crop in the air like a child with a toy. It was a new crop, made of black leather, from the end of which sprouted a long braid of cellophane. Binz's dog was named Adelige, which means aristocratic lady, and she was the most magnificent and most terrifying Alsatian of them all, black and tan, with a thick shawl of fur around her chest, the type you could imagine a fine coat being made from. The dog responded to a series of commands, which Binz communicated by way of a green metal clicker. Binz walked straight to Mrs. Michalski and jabbed her out of line with a crop.
"You! Out!"
I tried to follow, but Matka held me back.
"What were you talking about?"
Binz asked, dog at her hip.
"Nothing, Madame Ordress,"
Mrs. Michalski said.
Irma stepped to Binz's side.
"The tally is complete, Madame Ordress."
Binz didn't answer, her gaze trained on Mrs. Michalski.
"My baby, Yagoda,"
Mrs. Michalski began.
"You have no baby. You have nothing. You are only a number."
Was Binz showing off for Irma? Mrs. Michalski held one hand out to Binz.
"She's a good baby."
Binz reached for the newspaper under Mrs. Michalski's shift and yanked it out in one motion.
"Where did you get this?" Binz asked.
Irma slid her clipboard under her arm and lit another cigarette. Mrs. Michalski stood taller.
"I don't know. I have nothing. I am only a number."
Even from 5 paces away, I could see Binz's whole body tremble.
"You're right," she said.
then drew back her arm and sent her crop across Mrs. Mikelski's cheek. The cellophane slashed Mrs. Mikelski's cheekbone, and after a quick look at Irma, Binz bent at the waist and unleashed her dog. Adeliga sat motionless at first, then at the chirp of Binz's clicker, lunged at Mrs. Mikelski, ears pinned back, teeth bared. The dog clamped her mouth around Mrs. Mikelski's hand, shook it side to side, and pulled my teacher to her knees. The dog's growls echoed around the square as she lunged and bit the neckline of Mrs. Mikelski's shift and brought her down onto the snow. Matka took my hand in hers. Mrs. Mikelski rolled to her side and tried to sit, but the dog clamped her jaws around her throat and shook its head back and forth. I held back the urge to retch as the dog dragged Mrs. Mikelski away from us like a wolf with a freshly killed deer, leaving a cherry stain along the snow. The chirp of Binz's metal clicker echoed about the plots.
Adeliga, release! Binz called out.
The dog sat back on her haunches and panted, her golden eyes trained on Binz.
7776, Binz shouted.
Irma tossed away her cigarette and let it lie there on the snow, a lazy blue spiral rising from it as she wrote on her clipboard. The dog trotted to Binz, tail between her legs, and left Mrs. Mikelski lying motionless. Binz turned and waved me out of line. I stepped one pace out.
Your friend?
I nodded.
Yes? How so?
My math teacher, Madame Wardress. Tears blurred my sight, but I held them back. Tears only inflamed Binz. Irma touched her fingers to her pretty mouth and smiled.
Polish math.
Binz tossed me a violet grease pen.
Write it, she said.
We'd all witnessed the process. Binz wanted me to write the number on Mrs. Mikelski's chest, the final indignity for every dead or dying prisoner. My heart hammered as I stepped along the dark cherry trail Adeliga had left in the snow to where my teacher lay. I found Mrs. Mikelski on her back, the flesh at her throat ripped to the bone, and there was blood smeared across her bare chest as if painted there. Her face was turned toward me, eyes partially open, the gash across her cheekbone like a gaping smile.
Write it, Binz said.
With my jacket sleeve, I wiped the blood from Mrs. Mikelski's chest and wrote in grease pen, 7776.
Remove that piece, Binz said.
She wanted the body dragged to the pile beside the linen shop. I took hold of both of Mrs. Mikelski's wrists and dragged her, still warm, across the snow, exhaling the white fog of my breath like a plow horse. The horror of it, the hate, grew black in my chest. How could I live without revenge? By the time I reached the stack of bodies, snow-covered and shoulder-high, my face was wet with tears. I tucked Mrs. Mikelski along the side of the pile with great care, as if she were sleeping there. Our lioness, our hope, our North Star.
Poles, Irma said to Binz as I walked by her back to line up. Why do they even try to teach them math? True, said Binz with a laugh.
I stopped and turned to Irma. At least I can count, I said. This time, I didn't have to wait for the sting of Binz's crop.
Chapter 14. Hertha, 1941. I stayed at Ravensbrück. Once I received word my father had died and Mutti would need rehabilitative care for her back, my salary became more important. It was lonely there with only male doctors for company, so I kept to my office when Fritz was not available and worked on my scrapbooks. I pasted in a photo that Fritz had asked a waiter to snap of us lunching in Fürstenberg, matchbooks, and other souvenirs. So many newspaper clippings. German infantry had just invaded the Soviet Union with great success, so there were many positive articles to save. I wrote back and told Mutti how hard I was working to get the Revier cleaned up and running efficiently. How I expected the Commandant would notice my hard work if I somehow brought a sense of order to that place. On my way back to my cottage one night after my daily duties concluded, I noticed a light on in the bookbindery and stopped, hoping to find someone there to talk with. Binz sat on a low stool, back straight, in full uniform, her chin high. A prisoner with a red badge sat in a chair nearby, sketching her. It was a pole I'd seen in processing, the one with the ring Binz had sped on to pull off. There was a pale band of white skin on her finger where the ring had once been. Binz waved me into the room, a compact space devoted to the production of the Reich's educational materials. Stacks of pamphlets and books sat on a long table along one wall. "Come in, doctor. I'm just having my portrait drawn." "Please be still, Madame Overseer," said the prisoner. "I can't draw if you're talking." A prisoner giving Binz orders? Even stranger, Binz was obeying them. "Halina here is our resident master artist," Binz said. "You should see the portrait Kögel commissioned. You'd swear the medals are real." The prisoner stopped sketching. "Should I come back another time, Madame Overseer?" Anyone would notice that the bookbindery, once a mess of paper, ink, and supplies, had become vastly more organized. "Commissioned?" I said to the prisoner. "How are you paid?" "In bread, Madame Doctor," she said.
"She gives it away to the other Poles," said Binz. "Crazy in the head."
It was soothing, almost hypnotic, to watch her sketch, the pencil tapping out rough little lines on the paper.
"You're Polish? Your German is good." "Fooled me too," Binz said.
"My mother was German," the prisoner said as she sketched, her eyes trained on Binz. "Grew up on an estate not far from Osnabrück."
"And your father?"
"Born in Cologne, where his mother was raised, his father was Polish."
"So you are Group 3 on the Deutsche Volksliste," Binz said.
The German People's List categorized Poles into four categories. Group 3 consisted of persons of mostly German stock who had become Polonized.
"As close to German as you can get," I said.
"If you say so, Madame Doctor." I smiled.
"If a chicken lays an egg in a pigsty, does that make the chick a piglet?"
"No, Madame Doctor." I walked behind the prisoner and watched her finish the shading on Binz's chin. The portrait was remarkable. It captured Binz's strength and complex personality along with her likeness.
"I'm giving this portrait to Edmund for his birthday," Binz said. "I wanted a nude version, but she isn't good at those."
Halina colored slightly but kept her eyes focused on her pad.
"You should commission a portrait, Doctor," Binz said. "Your mother would like it."
Would my mother care about a portrait of me now that father had died and she was busy with her new life? Binz smiled.
"All it will cost you is bread."
The prisoner put down her pencil. "I really should get back for Appell."
"Halina, I'll fix it with your Blokova," Binz said. "Sit down, Doctor. What else are you doing tonight?"
Binz walked around the prisoner to look at the finished product and clapped her hands together like a delighted child.
"I'm giving this to Edmund tonight. Make sure you turn the light out and, Halina, I'll tell your Blokova you'll be in by 9. I will send a white loaf tomorrow for this."
I took Binz's place on the stool. Helena turned to a fresh piece of paper and began sketching, taking a peek at me now and then.
"Why were you sent here?" I asked.
"I don't know, Madame Doctor."
"How can you not know? You were arrested?"
"My daughters were arrested, and I tried to keep them from taking them."
"Arrested for what?"
"I don't know."
"Probably the underground."
"What did you do when you went to Osnabrück?"
"We visited my grandparents' country house," said the prisoner in excellent German. "He was a judge. My grandmother was Judy Schneider."
"The painter?
The Führer collects her paintings."
The prisoner had the same talent the Führer admired so much in her grandmother.
"And where in Poland are you from?"
"Lublin, Madame Doctor."
"There's a well-known medical school there," I said.
"Yes, I completed my nursing certificate there."
"You are a nurse?
How nice it would be to have someone cultured and bright to talk medicine with."
"Yes, was. I illustrated children's books before."
"We could use you in the Riviera."
"I haven't been a practicing nurse in 10 years, Madame Doctor."
"Nonsense. I will have Binz reassign you immediately. What block did you end up in?"
32, Madame Doctor."
"You will be a Lagerprominent and move to block 1.
Please, I would like to stay."
"The Revier prisoner staff lives in block 1. You will not only be treating prisoners, but the SS staff and their families. You will find clean bed linens in block 1 and not a single louse."
"Yes, Madame Doctor. Could my daughters come with me?"
She said this nonchalantly, as if she did not care. This was out of the question, of course. Block 1 was reserved for Class 1 workers only.
"Maybe later. The food is fresh, and you receive double rations."
I didn't mention that the food in the elite barracks did not contain the drug they put in the regular soup to kill the prisoner's sex drive and seize menses. After 2 more sessions, Helena completed my portrait, covered it with translucent white paper, and left it for me in my office. I lifted the paper and was taken aback. The level of detail was astonishing. No one had captured me so perfectly before. A woman doctor of the Reich in my lab coat, strong and focused. Mutti would frame it. It took a few days to get Helena transferred from the bookbindery to the Revier. The infirmary was technically not an SS operation, but an offshoot, so bureaucratic matters took extra time. Jowly, square-jawed Nurse Marshall was the only one not happy with the arrangement. She lumbered to my office, where she squawked like a goose the day we moved her out of her seat at the Revier front desk and replaced her with Helena. I transferred Nurse Marshall to a perfectly good office in the rear of the building, a former supply closet. From the first hour Helena took charge, the Revier improved. The patients responded to her efficient manner, no doubt a result of her German ancestry. By the end of the day, most beds were emptied, the workshy back at work, and the entire building disinfected. There was no need to babysit Helena, since her decision-making skills were almost equal to mine, and this allowed me to tackle my backlog of paperwork. Finally, I had a partner I could rely on. The commandant would surely notice the change in no time. Later that month, Binz came up with a plan she considered brilliant. For weeks, the male staff had planned a trip to Berlin to coincide with Commandant Kugel's absence while he was in Bonn. It was to be a special mission, which they thought was secret. But the female staff knew the details of this mission thanks to several of Binz's Aufseherinnen, who regularly slept with the male guards. It was to be a trip to Salon Kitty, a high-class brothel in a wealthy part of Berlin. Fritz, home visiting his mother in Cologne, had escaped the trip, but almost all the other male staff members emptied out of the camp into buses and motored off, looking like naughty schoolboys on holiday. This left the following people in charge of the camp: Binz and her Aufseherinnen, three older male SS tower guards who patrolled the wall, one poor gate guard who had drawn the short straw, and me. "I hope there is no escape attempt while you're gone," I had said to Adolf Winkelmann as he prepared to leave. "It has all been approved, Dr. Oberhäuser. You are the ranking officer in charge tonight. Extra Postenkette have been arranged as a precaution." I was glad for the extra tower guards, expert marksmen all, but they were not allowed to leave their posts. Winkelmann shuffled off toward the bus as several of our esteemed colleagues called out the windows, threatening to leave him behind. In their absence, Binz suggested a party at one of the Aufseherinnen's houses, a snug, chalet-like home at the far end of the staff compound outside the camp walls. They'd planned the celebration with great pains. There was to be a drinking relay, dancing, and card games. They had even had some Polish heftlings snip their famous paper cuttings from scarlet tissue paper and then strung them like garlands about the house. I decided to forego this party and stay at my office with Halina to finish some work. This was not a hardship, because for the first time since I'd come to camp, I had an intelligent friend, someone whose company I enjoyed, instead of just Binz, who told filthy stories. Not only had Halina cleaned up the Revier and reduced by 3/4 the number of patients awaiting treatment, she also still completed important projects for the commandant in the bookbindery. She showed me the books she was assembling for Himmler himself. They chronicled the Angora rabbit fur operation at each camp, complete with detailed photos. Ravensbrück's was one of the best fur producers, with twice the number of cages as Dachau. Halina bound the books by hand, wrapping each cover with soft Angora fabric. "You have so much paperwork, Madame Doctor," Halina said. "How can I help?" How quick she was with that, my favorite phrase. What a pleasure to spend time with a competent prisoner who was not afraid of me. Halina had no hunted animal look, none of that contagious terror that sent me looking at the clouds or at a beetle in the yard. At anything but them. "Address the envelopes and I will insert the cards," I said. We mailed condolence cards, also known as comfort cards, to the families of prisoners who died at the camp by any number of means. Those chosen as special handling cases and terminated. Those shot trying to escape. Those who died by natural causes. In my terrible doctor handwriting, I wrote, "Body cannot be inspected due to hygienic considerations," on most cards, in case the family wanted to view the body. It was a ridiculous charade, and added at least 10 extra hours of work to my already busy week. But the commandant required it for appearance's sake. Halina addressed envelopes whenever she had a spare moment, until her piles far outnumbered my completed cards. "It must be hard for a family to receive such a note," Halina said, addressing an envelope in her flowing script. Had tears come to her eyes? With the condolence card was included an official form so the family could apply for their prisoner's ashes. 4 pounds of generic ashes were sent per female prisoner in a tin canister if a request was approved. At least I was not responsible for coordinating all that. "We can take a break from this," I said. Halina sat up straighter. "Oh, no, Madame Doctor, I'm fine, but I do have a favor to ask of you. Please tell me if..." "Yes, get on with it." Halina had been a great help to me. Didn't I owe it to her to at least listen to her request? She pulled a letter from her pocket. I wonder if you could post this, just a letter to my friend. It appeared to be written on camp stationery. Post it yourself, you're allowed. Helena rested one hand on the sleeve of my lab coat. There was a piece of blue string knotted on her ring finger. But the censors cut them to pieces, take out even remarks about the weather or one's digestion. I took the letter from her. It was addressed to Herr Lennart Fleischer at a Lublin address. What harm was there in sending such a letter? After all, Helena had been valuable to the Reich. There was plenty harm in it, though. If I was caught, the punishment could be severe. I would be reprimanded at best. I will think about it, I said, and slipped it in my desk drawer. Helena bent her head back over her task. Thank you, Madame Doctor. From my office in the Riviera, I could hear music and laughter coming from Binz's party at the staff quarters at the far end of the camp in the woods. I chafed at the thought that almost every man in the camp had to leave before I was considered highest in rank. Less than 1 hour into the evening, Helena and I were making excellent progress when a great bang was heard and the vibration from it shook the ground. Helena and I just looked at each other and then went about our work. Had it been a car backfiring? Loud noises were not uncommon at the camp and were often amplified by the lake. Seconds later, Binz and others could be heard shouting from the direction of the party. Dr. Oberhäuser, come! Irma has been hurt! Helena and I looked at each other, struck dumb. In such situations, the instinct of a medical professional takes over. Helena stood and ran out. I followed close behind. We came to the main camp gate and could hear a great many cries from the direction of the house in the distant wood. Open the gate, I said to the guard. But, his gaze went to Helena, no prisoner was allowed to leave through that gate unless accompanied by an Aufseherin. Do it! You know I outrank you! Why does a woman's voice so often not command the respect it deserves? After more stalling, the guard finally opened the gate. Helena hesitated. Come, I said. I needed an assistant, but would I be reprimanded for this? Helena hurried with me toward the house, the sound of her heavy clogs muffled as we ran from cobblestone road to the soft pine needles of the woods. Abundant moonlight allowed us to see the house at the end of the pine grove, all light extinguished within. Binz came running from the direction of the house. The kitchen collapsed, and Irma's down, Binz called. Irma Grese was one of Binz's most fervent disciples and, some argued, more severe in her punishments than Binz. What would the commandant say? Helena and I ran toward the house, and Binz followed. For God's sake, Binz, how did this happen? I asked. The gas stove. She lit her cigarette there, and the damn thing just went up. I told her not to smoke. Helena and I entered the house and found Irma unresponsive on the living room floor. The electricity had been knocked out by the blast, and the room smelled of gas. The kitchen wall behind the stove had been blown clear off, and above the stove, a mangled piece of metal swayed, making a strangely human groaning sound. Even the wall calendar near us was knocked askew. Helena and I knelt beside Irma. Even in the near darkness, I could see her accelerated breathing. Shock. Blood soaked the shoulder of her dress. Someone get a blanket, I said. And a candle, Binz said. There is still gas in the air, Helena said. Get a battery-powered flashlight, a good strong one. Binz paused a second. Take orders from a prisoner? A flashlight, Binz called over her shoulder. I tried to apply direct pressure to Emma's shoulder, but it was difficult to see in the darkness. The metallic smell of human blood was unmistakable, though. In seconds, I felt the rug become wet, turning into a sticky pool. "Need to move her back to the Revier," I said.
"She won't make it," Halina said. "Have to work here."
Was she mad?
"We have nothing."
Binz's guards huddled around us, quiet. Halina hesitated a long moment. Reluctant to save the life of an Aufseherin? She then reached over and ripped the sleeve off Irma's dress. Binz lunged toward Halina.
"What is she doing?"
I held Binz back. "Exposing the wound," I said. This not only gave us access to the injury, but also revealed the source of the bleeding. One of Binz's girls came with a strong light, and we saw the extent of the damage. Loss of consciousness, multiple contusions, second-degree burns, and cyanosis, clammy blue skin, a symptom of shock. But the most immediate problem was the source of the blood loss, a gash the size of a deck of playing cards in her upper arm, perhaps inflicted by a piece of projectile iron from the stove. The wound was so deep, the bone was clearly visible. I held my fingers to Irma's wrist, but could barely find a pulse. These injuries were not compatible with life. Halina slipped her uniform shift over her head, leaving her in only gray undershorts and wooden clogs in the cold night. She kicked off her clogs and ripped her uniform into long strips 2 inches wide. It was hard not to marvel at Halina's decisiveness as she went about this task. The exertion brought color to her cheek, and her eyes shone in the light. This was the work she was meant to do. Until then, I'd not realized how underweight Halina had become. Even on Block 1 rations, she had become wasted, especially about the hips and thighs. But her skin was unblemished and creamy white, the color of fresh milk. She practically glowed in the low light.
"We have to get to the Revier," Binz said.
I joined Halina, and we ripped strips of cotton. She wrapped the cloth strips 2 inches above the injury and tied them with the perfect overhand knot.
"First, a tourniquet," I said to Binz.
I walked to the calendar on the wall and pulled the wooden dowel from it. I handed it to Halina, and she tied 2 cloth strips to the stick to make a torsion device. I helped her twist the stick until the material was tight and the bleeding stopped. Soon the patient was responsive, and we made a blanket sling onto which 4 Aufseherinnen lifted Irma and hurried back to camp. I ordered an Aufseherin to fetch a blanket and arranged it across Halina's shoulders, for she was trembling after that performance. Halina and I followed Binz and her girls out the door of the house as they carried Irma back to the Revier. I considered follow-up care. We'd start an intravenous drip. Halina paused there in the darkness. What was she doing? She looked out toward the lake, which shimmered in the moonlight as if diamonds were scattered there.
"What is it?" I asked.
Was she in shock, too?
"Halina, there's much to be done."
Then the thought occurred to me. She was considering escape. Could it be? A prisoner clothed only in a blanket and undershorts would not get far. Only 3 escapes had been attempted at Ravensbrück, and 2 had ended badly for those heftlings who were brought back to camp, made to wear a placard with the words, "Hurrah, hurrah, I'm back again," on it, tortured, and then shot at the wall. That was all I needed, an escape on my watch. "Come along," I said. Halina stood still, her blonde hair bright in the moonlight, face hidden in the shadows. In the quiet, I heard the lapping of the lake waves on the shore.
"Now," I said,
That patient needs follow-up care. Helena barely moved in the darkness. An arc of light from the tower swept the yard and moved onto the lake. They were looking for us. You've done a great service to the Reich tonight, Helena. You'll be rewarded, I'm sure of it. Come along now. The dogs in the kennel barked. How long before we would be reported missing and the dogs would be released? Still, Helena did not move. Were the guards watching us from the towers? She inhaled deeply, then exhaled, and the fog of her breath rose like a specter lit by the moon. I just wanted to look at the camp from here, she said in a faraway voice. Why had I let her come out of those gates? Helena inhaled once more. It's been so long since I've breathed free air. The lake, it's so... Hurry, now, I said. Quite slowly, she joined me, and we walked back to the Revier. The sound of her wooden clogs loud on the road, my coat soaked through with perspiration. Not until the gate closed behind us did I allow myself to breathe fully once again. Word of that evening's events spread quickly the next day. Once the commandant returned and the men rolled back in from their brothel trip, the commandant personally told me how much he appreciated my quick thinking and said he'd write to Himmler of my ingenuity and bravery in saving one of the Reich's best workers. The whole camp lauded my efforts, except Nurse Marshall, of course, who remained cold and tight-lipped when the subject came up, jealous a Pole had assisted me. Later that week, Helena and I sat finishing up some paperwork, side by side, at my desk. By then, we barely had to speak. We knew each other's rhythms and routines so well around the office. Herblokova had given her permission to stay past lights out, so I knew we would have a chance to visit. That morning, I had been to the Bekleidung building, known to all as the booty piles, the Reich's great assemblage of goods confiscated from Hitler's conquered nations. These materials, clothing, silver, dishes, and the like, were well sorted, and I quickly found many helpful things, including a warm sweater for Helena and a phonograph with a limited selection of recordings. I had a green badge set it up in my office, cranked it, and played some music with the volume low. A Bible girl brought us bread and cheese from the officers' dining hall, more for Helena than me, and I put a record on the phonograph. Foxtrot from Warsaw. I love this song, Helena said. I turned the volume down. No need for the whole Revier to hear me playing a Polish song. Helena swayed slightly to the music as she addressed her envelopes. I learned the foxtrot to the song. Can you teach me? I asked. What was the harm? Everyone at the camp knew this step but me. There had been no time for these things in medical school. Helena shook her head. Oh, I don't think... I stood. I insist. Helena rose quite slowly. Madam Doctor, I'm not the best teacher. I smiled. Hurry, before the song is done. She reached one hand to my back and took my hand with the other. The hold is up, Helena said, like other ballroom dances. We took two steps forward and then one to the side in time to the music. Helena had sold herself short. She was an excellent teacher. Slow, slow, quick, quick, do you see? It was not a difficult dance. Right away I mastered it. Helena kept me turning about the small office, the two of us perfectly in sync. Soon we both were laughing at how ridiculously well we danced together. I hadn't laughed like that since coming to the camp. We stopped, out of breath. I brushed a lock of hair back off Helena's forehead. Helena turned, and I felt her stiffen. I turned as well, and found Nurse Marshall in the doorway, a supply requisition form in hand. Neither of us had heard the door open. I tried to catch my breath. "What is it, Marshall?" Helena lifted the needle from the record. "I have a supply order," Marshall said. "I was going to leave it on your desk, but I see you are busy." Her eyes flashed to Helena. "Plus, you left the apothecary closet open."
"I'll take care of it. I'm busy, if you don't mind."
Nurse Marshall handed me the form and withdrew, but not without sending Helena a penetrating look. Once Marshall left and shut the door as quietly as she'd opened it, Helena and I looked at each other. Something intangible had been let out of a box, something dangerous, and there was no going back.
"She needs to learn to knock," I said.
Helena stared at me, her face drained of color. "She seems unhappy, Madame Doctor."
"The barking dog never bites," I said with a shrug. "She's useless."
If only I'd known the price of underestimating Nurse Marshall.
Chapter 15. Caroline. 1941. I gripped the edge of my file cabinet drawer. "What is it, Roger?"
"I just heard, Caroline. They found Paul's and Rina's names on an arrest roster."
"Paul arrested?" "Thank you for not telling me in front of Pia."
I kept the tears at bay, but my manila files swam in a blur.
"Any word on Rina's father? He lived with them in Rouen."
"Not yet. I check the sheets every hour. You know, of course, we'll do whatever it takes to track them."
"At least we know they're alive, right? On what charges were they arrested?"
"Wish I knew. Our London intelligence is spotty. No destinations listed either. There's more, see. 3 million German troops have begun marching into Russia."
"What about the non-aggression pact?" "Hitler was a lying madman, but every new reversal came as a fresh slap."
"Hitler ignored it, see. The bear is not Epi."
Roger loved referring to the Soviets as the bear. It did seem an apt name.
"Hitler's taking whatever he wants. This doesn't bode well for us."
He didn't have to say it. Before long, Hitler would own half the world. Would England be the next to go?
"I'm sorry about all this, see."
Roger seemed genuinely sad. Perhaps he regretted not acting on Rina's behalf. I barely functioned that day, numb with what-ifs. What if Paul had stayed here, safe in New York? What if I'd pushed Roger Moore to wrangle Rina a visa? To complicate the day, I received a call informing me that Betty Stockwell Merchant had delivered a 7-pound baby boy she named Walter after her father. Though work was busy, I snuck away at lunch to visit her at the hospital. I was desperate to see the baby, though I'd been stuffing down jealousy since I'd heard the news, along with a few jelly donuts. I hoped a change of venue would clear my head. It would be nice to share my concerns about Paul with Betty. I bought Betty's favorite parrot tulips on the way to the hospital. Not that she needed more flowers. Her suite at St. Luke's looked like Whirlaway's stables at the Kentucky Derby. Flowers and grape sprays, a horseshoe of roses, and carnations on an easel with a sash across it reading, "Congratulations." In a vase, 2 dozen roses dyed baby blue hung their heads in shame. "Thank you for the tulips, Caroline," Betty said. She lay propped up with down pillows in her custom hospital bed, lovely in a pink satin bed jacket and matching turban. "You always know what I like." A nurse came in with the baby, her crepe soles silent on the tile. Seeing him pushed my troubles to the background.
Go ahead and hold him, Betty said with a wave in our direction. The baby settled in warm against me, swaddled tight. His fists were balled under his chin, his face prize-fighter swollen. Little Walter would have to be pugnacious to survive parents who got along best when in separate time zones.
I know it sounds ungrateful, Caroline, but I'm not ready for a baby, Betty said.
She held a hanky to one tear duct.
How can you say that, dear? I told Phil I didn't want a child this soon, but he didn't listen. And after all I've done for him, I wore golf shoes for that man.
You'll be a wonderful mother.
The service is excellent here, Caroline, Betty said, brightening. Better than the plaza. I'm telling you. They were bringing the baby in at all hours, and I had to tell them to keep him in the nursery. They specialize in infants.
What a beautiful baby, I said. I stroked his fist, petal soft. Walter stretched in my arms, and his eyelids fluttered in a baby dream. I felt the familiar ache and the tears welling up. Not now.
Now we just need to get you a husband and a baby, Caroline. In that order.
I'm done with all that, I said.
Have you started borrowing your mother's underwear yet?
No, right? Then you're not done.
The nurse came and took Walter, as if Betty had pressed the call button under her dining table for the maid. I held on to him until the last second before handing him to the nurse. My arms felt cold and empty as I watched them go.
Roger told me today that Paul and Rena were arrested, I said.
Oh, no, Caroline. I'm so sorry, dear. Do you know where they were taken?
I stepped to the window, arms folded across my chest. No one knows. To a Paris jail or some transit camp, probably. I don't know what to do.
Outside the window, down in the park, a boy tried to fly a kite, but its bottom bumped along, refusing to lift.
The tail is too heavy, I thought. Just take off the tail.
How terribly painful for you, darling, Betty said.
I can't work.
I'm having a luau party when I go home. Help me plan it. Or you could be my bridge partner for the Vanderbilt's party. I'm playing with Prue, but she'll gladly step aside.
I can't think about parties, Betty. I need to find out where they've taken Paul.
Let it go, see. It's all terribly sad, but you'll never have a normal life with Paul Rodier.
Who's to say what's normal?
Why do you always take the hard way? You and David could have...
David left me.
He would have married you if you'd been around more. A tent-city theater tour doesn't strengthen a relationship. Men like to be the center of your world. Now that you're more settled, you need to hurry up and get married and have children. A woman's eggs disintegrate, you know.
Just the mention of eggs floating inside me, fragile and microscopic, made me wince.
That's ridiculous, Betty. Tell that to your ovaries. There are eligible men all over New York, and you're chasing one in a French jail.
I have to get back to work.
Would it kill you to be sympathetic? We're talking about people's lives.
I'm sorry you don't want to hear it, but he's not quite our class, dear.
Our class? My father made his own way in life. After his parents sent him to St. Paul's...
With all due respect to your brother, being pampered by one's parents fails to build character.
That coming from a woman who was dressed by maids until she was 16. Oh, let's be practical about all this, Caroline. It's not too late, you know.
To what? Save my reputation? marry someone I can't stand just to have a luau partner? You may have the baby and the husband, but I want to be happy, Betty.
Betty picked at the satin hem of her blanket.
Fine, but don't cry to me when this ends badly.
I turned and left, wondering how I could have such a friend who didn't give a fig for my true happiness. I didn't need Betty. I had Mother. That would have to do for now. There was no earthly way I would give up on Paul.
Later that week, Roger told me the consulate could no longer help me fund the comfort packages I sent to France. The postcards and letters kept coming from the French orphanages, requesting help in the nicest possible way. How could I turn them down? I didn't dare ask Mother for money from her household account. Since Father had died, she'd been on a short leash. For a while, I hoped for a miracle, but then realized where I needed to go. Snyder and Goodrich Antiques. Years before, Mother had actually hinted we might consign some of the less used silver and donate the proceeds to charity. I wasn't surprised, for she'd inherited Mother Woolsey's inclination toward charity along with her sterling. She never measured our worth in troy ounces, so I knew we wouldn't miss a few oyster forks that hadn't been touched since the Civil War. I'd never part with the dinner forks, of course. The Snyder and Goodrich Antiques shop was just far enough downtown to be discreet, located next to a thriving little shop that sold realistic hair pieces. Everyone acted differently once they ended up at Snyder and Goodrich, selling their family heirlooms to support a rummy uncle or an overdue tax bill. Betty's second cousin, whose husband went to jail for tax evasion, swallowed a bottle of pills the day her wedding china went down to Snyder and Goodrich. She recovered, but her reputation never did. Those with buckets of money to spare didn't care a fig about appearances. After spring cleaning, they'd send a liveried chauffeur or uniformed housemaid down to S&G with the items to be disposed of. A dingy Hamadan carpet, Limoges finger bowls. Mother never kept a chauffeur for the city, and our few maids left on staff were up at the hay. So one morning I took a roll of oyster forks from the pyramid of rolled Pacific cloth bundles in the silver closet at the apartment, and delivered them myself. Mr. Snyder would no doubt be glad to see the Woolsey silver. I stepped through the shop door into a haze of cigar smoke. Inside, one got the impression there were more glass cases in that room than in the entire Museum of Natural History. The walls were filled with floor-to-ceiling cases, and more ran around the perimeter of the room, counter high and a body's length from the wall. All showed the linty evidence of fresh windexing and stood choked with household artifacts arranged according to category. Swords in ornate tasseled sheaths, coins and paintings and legions of matching stemware, and the sterling silver and silver plate, of course, in separate cases, kept a discreet distance apart. A trim man, well into his 60s, stood at one of the waist-high cases. He'd spread out pages of the New York Times there and was polishing a silver caviar set atop them with his wooden matches, orange sticks and polishing rags arranged in a ring around an article. I could read the headline upside down. Hitler begins war on Russia, with armies on march from Arctic to the Black Sea. Damascus falls. U.S. ousts Rome consuls. The man introduced himself as Mr. Snyder, unfurled my felt roll, and extracted one oyster fork, as gently as one extracts saffron from a crocus. With his jeweler's loop to one eye, he examined the Woolsey family crest atop it. Mr. Snyder would no doubt be impressed with that coat of arms. Extraordinary in sterling. Two filigreed lions in silhouette holding the crest aloft. Above it, a naked arm, shin bone in hand, rising from a medieval knight's helmet. Mr. Snyder read the words inscribed on the band of the crest. Manus haec inimica tyrannis. It's our family code. It means, this hand with shin bone shall only be raised in anger against a tyrant or tyranny itself. How could Mr. Snyder not be eager to have such history in his shop? What is your best price? I asked.
This is not a tag sale, Miss Faraday. Klinenkorf Flea Market is that way, he said, pointing in the direction of Paris with one tarnished blackened finger.
Mr. Snyder spoke excellent English with just a trace of a German accent. Though his name sounded English, he was of German extraction. I assumed Snyder was once spelled Schneider and was anglicized for business reasons. After World War I, transplanted Germans had been the targets of American prejudice, though that tide had turned recently in the United States, and many Americans were decidedly pro-German. The name Goodrich had probably been added to make the store sound British, for there was no evidence of a Mr. Goodrich. Mr. Snyder felt the oyster fork all over as a blind man might feel a face, flexed the ends of the tines, then huffed a breath onto it.
Tines not stretched? That's good. Hallmark is clogged. Have these been dipped?
Never, I said. Only cotton wool and goddards. I fought the urge to curry favor with a smile. With the French, at least, smiling was a tactical error, a sign of American weakness. Mr. Snyder took the four-sided end of a wooden matchstick and twirled it in the hallmark. The pink of his scalp, which shone through his thin white hair, matched the polish on his rag.
Good, Mr. Snyder said.
He waved a finger at me.
But always leave silver tarnished, and polish as you need it. Tarnish protects it.
The silver belonged to my great-grandmother Eliza Woolsey, I said. I was surprised that I suddenly wanted to cry.
Everything in here belonged to someone's great-grandmother. I've not taken a lemon, sardine, cherry, or oyster fork in 5 years. Never mind, you're 12. No market for them.
For someone who proclaimed the benefits of tarnish, he kept his own sterling well-shined. Maybe I'll try Sotheby's, I said. Mr. Snyder began rolling up the brown cloth.
Fine. They don't know a bouillon spoon from a nut scoop.
The Woolsey silver is featured in the book Treasures of the Civil War. He waved one hand toward the case behind him.
That Astor punch bowl is from the French Revolution.
Mr. Snyder changed his attitude once I switched to his native tongue. For the first time, I was happy Father had insisted I learn German. The book also mentions a loving cup which belonged to my great-grandmother Eliza Woolsey, I said, forcing the German past tense of belong from some deep recess.
How do you know German?
He asked with a smile. School. Chapin.
Is your loving cup sterling? He asked, continuing in German.
Yes, and gold. Given to her by the family of a young corporal she nursed at Gettysburg. He would have died from his wounds were it not for Eliza. And they sent her the cup with a lovely letter.
Gettysburg. A terrible battle. Is the cup engraved?
To Eliza Woolsey with deepest gratitude, I said. It features the god Pan on the front holding baskets of gold flowers.
Do you still have the letter?
Yes, it details the corporal's escape from the swamps of Chickahominy.
Good provenance, Mr. Snyder said.
I would have taken a bullet rather than part with that cup. But the story softened Mr. Snyder enough for him to make me an offer on the forks.
$45 is my best, he said. Sterling hasn't recovered since the difficulties.
It had been more than 10 years since Black Tuesday. By 1941, our economy was on the mend, but some people could still not bring themselves to say the word depression.